It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll look at a proposed change to utility rates here in Wisconsin and what that can mean for energy-conscious consumers.
First, we're continuing our week-long series, On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture. Every day at 5, we're examining a different side of the state's relationship with alcohol. Yesterday, we talked to a doctor about how alcohol affects the body.
Today, we're zeroing in on one Wisconsin county's solution to repeat drunk driving offenders, special alternative treatment programs. While drunk driving isn't the only problem caused by alcohol use and misuse, it's one of the most well-known consequences.
Michael Olig is with us. He's the coordinator of the Safe Streets Treatment Option Program for the Winnebago County Human Services Department. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Well, let's start by looking at this thing in context. Why are people in Wisconsin drinking and driving?
Well, I just want to say before we begin that I'd like to remember all the people who are suffering because of alcohol-related problems. I hope they experience some healing from those, and that my observations about impaired driving in Wisconsin don't represent those of my employers. I think the why people drink and drive, explicitly it states in our statutes that people should not drive under the influence of something that impairs their driving ability. Yet we provide many opportunities for on-premise consumption in Wisconsin. And it implies to people that this is something that they're all right to do. It's all right to do. And they're kind of not somewhat enticed or encouraged to go out and do it, from going to a bar to a restaurant or the many public and community events that serve alcohol as part of the event. It seems to draw a lot of people in. And they use it. And so it seems to be a conflicting message in my view.
So what you're saying is that society's really sending mixed messages when it comes to drinking and driving. On the one hand, you've got the law enforcement side and public health saying, you know, this endangers people and drivers.
Yes.
On the other hand, a lot of social almost encouragement of
yes.
drinking and then getting in your car, I guess.
I think that's what it appears to be. You know, the way I view it is Wisconsin doesn't seem to have a problem with impaired driving. They have a problem with people who are apprehended for impaired driving. And there's a tendency to scapegoat the individuals apprehended for it, and I think that's probably the tip of the iceberg. There wouldn't be as many venues serving alcohol if there wasn't a demand for consumption.
Now, I know this is something that isn't just theory to you. This is something that really hit home in your own family. Could you tell us how you got interested?
Sure. Back in 2007, my son attended a Dave Matthews concert, and we had talked about, you know, making sure that he doesn't drink excessively and drive, and that he was going to have some drinks early in the evening and then drive back to Oshkosh. And he did, but he didn't really calculate how much he drank. And on the drive back to Oshkosh, he got in an accident, fell asleep, and ran into a wall. He suffered a TBI. He was in the hospital at Frederick for 12 days and then did about 4 weeks rehabilitation at home. His BAC at the time of when they took it was 0.10. In his mind, he thought he was, you know, safe to drive, and, you know, he risked that. Some of the messages, you know, that people get is you can have two and drive, but it doesn't always take into consideration who's having the two, who's mixing the two, what size glass you're using. Is it a standard glass? Are you male or female? What's your weight? What's your gender? Many other factors that influence BAC levels. And so he tried to do the thing that's recommended, monitors alcohol use, wait what he thought was a long enough period, and then drive home. Unfortunately, he had an accident and injured himself and his girlfriend.
And as I understand it, that was part of the wake-up call to you, that you thought more deeply about this, and then he got another OWI.
Yes, he did. Unfortunately, when somebody has a TBI, they don't remember a lot after the injury. And 3 weeks later, or 3 weeks after he got his license back, he had lost it, I think, for about, 36 months or so. He went to a bar. He planned to stay overnight at his friend's, gave his keys to the bartender, and proceeded to have some cocktails. As the evening progressed, he thought it was boring, so he was able to convince a drinking bartender to give him his keys back, and once again, he risked driving home and was cited for another OWI.
And what did that say to you when this happened so closely together? I mean, I guess society looks at that and said, you know, that kid has some problems with alcohol. What did
right.
you see?
One thing is the social acceptability of impaired driving, meaning we wouldn't have places for on-premise consumption if it weren't socially acceptable. It's considered illegal, treated as being illegal, but most of the people who commit the offense aren't criminal. They've committed a criminal traffic offense, but they're not criminal. It's similar to speeding, though the, you know, speeding's illegal, but yet people do it. And about 31,000 people die annually in speed-related accidents. So I started thinking about what's going on here in the socialization process. You're born in a culture and raised in a culture where alcohol is sold in so many different venues for on-premise consumption, and the advertising, the media. You know, you have conflicting messages where a newspaper may run an ad about OWIs and the legislature should criminalize the first, and next to it is a happy hour ad. You know, so it's kind of like, okay, which way should we go with this? You know, and I think that much of the information is communicated or perceived subliminally. People don't really, they witness what's going on. Like, for instance, if I go out to eat, I'll watch people's consumption. And many people go and have two cocktails and they feel they're safe to drive, but they really don't know. And, you know, that's people who are going out there that they're probably over 0.08, but they don't realize it.
Now, a lot of people would look at this and say, I think I know who these people are. They're people who are alcoholics getting behind the wheel. But is there a typical profile for a drunk driver?
I have not seen it yet. I would, in the program that I run, we just went over 1,000 people. I would say 95% of the people I would trust riding with them, with my house, watching my house, family members, and so on. There are persons who, other than the offense of impaired driving, do not do anything criminal. So it's really hard to, you know, have a stereotype. There are people out there who are doing it intentionally and maliciously, but many people just, you know, will risk it. And given that we allow people to have up to 0.08 before they can be, you know, arrested for OWI, it impairs their decision-making, judgment, and insight. And so they don't really know if they're over the limit or not.
Now, Wisconsin is a state that has a well-known problem with drinking culture and with drunk driving. You're at the vanguard of a new program that's trying to turn it around. What is STOP?
STOP is the Safe Streets Treatment Options Program. It began on December 1st, 2006. It was decided by our Safe Streets Treatment Program Committee, which is a group of people in the community who gather to look at alternatives to incarceration. It's a program that offers an alternative to incarceration for second and third OWI offenders in Winnebago County who are residents of Winnebago County. The individuals can opt for the program on a one-time basis. And it tries to balance rehabilitation and a consequence for the behavior in an effort to enhance community safety and return the person back to society as a productive citizen.
So they get one chance to accept this program and go through it. What happens then once they take you up on it?
When they do, they will meet with me, and I'm an intoxicated driver program assessor in Wisconsin, meaning I'm able to do the assessment that the Department of Transportation requires for individuals charged with OWI. I do the assessment, and it yields a finding. From that finding, I make a recommendation. Some individuals are referred to an educational program at the technical colleges, which is called Multiple Offender Program. That's 30 hours of classroom instruction with a 90-day follow-up. And other individuals are referred to treatment for a substance abuse problem.
And before we go to news, tell us how it's doing so far.
Well, to date, we've had 716 people who've completed the program. We've had the recidivism rate for the last seven, three-quarter years is about 11%. That's the restate that. The rearrest rate, the recidivism rate, you can't really calculate that. I can only look on CCAP, which is the state website, to see if people committed other offenses. So it's been about 11%. And to date, we saved Winnebago County jail days saved is 26,000. 710. So it's delayed our having to add on to the jail or hire more personnel to manage this population who would have been in jail for the offense of second or third OWI.
We're talking right now with Mike Oleg of Winnebago County about alternative treatment options for multiple OWI offenders. It's the third installment of our week-long series, On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture. We're taking your calls next. Have you ever driven after drinking? Why did you think it was okay? Do you see some of those societal cues that it's something that is maybe acceptable in Wisconsin? Is drinking and driving a problem in your community? And how do you think Wisconsin should address drinking and driving? We're picking up our discussion now with Mike Oleg of the Winnebago County Human Services Department. He's talking about their alternative treatment program for multiple OWI offenders. It's called STOP. And we're taking your calls now. Have you ever gotten an OWI? And why did you at the time think that it was all right to drive after you'd been drinking? What do you think Wisconsin should do to decrease instances of OWI? And what solutions do you have? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Mike, we were talking about the program STOP in Winnebago County. That's the Safe Streets Treatment Option Program. And one thing that seems to distinguish it from other options out there is that there is this element of this personal relationship that you have with the person going through the program. How does that come into play?
Well, I meet with the individuals to do the assessment, and then I meet with them on a monthly basis, if not more frequently, based on their needs. And the relationship seems to have an effect on changing people's behavior. It's recognizing that this individual did commit this offense, but treating the individual with respect and a full expectation that they are going to return back to be a productive member of society and no longer commit the offense. One of the things about this program, it's not a traditional OWI court program where they have to appear before a judge weekly. Basically, the judges sentence the person to the program, and I manage and supervise the program for the course of the year. Should a problem arise with the individual where they're not compliant with the program, we try to remedy that problem. And if they still don't comply, then we just refer them back to court, and then the courts will make a decision whether or not to continue them in the program or revoke them from the program.
I want to go to our phone lines now. We're going to talk to Jan first in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Jan.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're coming through fine.
All right, I'm on the road. I'm 54 right now, but when I was in my 20s, I did get picked up for what they called DWI at that time. And, you know, at that age, and I'm not so certain that things have changed, what we basically, I mean, my entire group of friends would drink and drive. It was just totally accepted. We would buzz over to Superior. Oftentimes, if we went out in Duluth, then we'd buzz over to Superior for bar closing because they were open an hour or two later. And we actually got picked up because, we were with the one of the guys that was in the band at this particular bar, and he and his friends were sending my girlfriend and I over drinks all night. And even though my home was only about 5 miles away, I was going too slow. I was going 40 in a 55, and so I got picked up. And, you know, at that time, I knew the ramifications of driving drunk. The counseling and the classes that I went to afterwards did me absolutely no good whatsoever. I mean, I was just sitting through it, and it was going in one ear out the other because I wasn't learning anything new. But when you're in your 20s and you're out and you're trying to meet guys and that's what's on your mind, you know, there's hormones going on and you just want to meet guys and you want to be comfortable in that bar setting, you grab your drink. And, you know, if you try and go through one night out there and you want to stay perfectly sober and not have a drink, it does ruin it for you if you're used to going out and having fun.
I want to ask you, did it change things for you? You said the counseling was worthless, but did the experience overall and going through it change the way you related to drinking and driving later on?
Well, I suppose to a point it did. I have to say, honestly, I just thank God that I'm married right now, and my husband and I don't do socializing like that. We don't go out to the bars. I'm afraid that if I was still single and I was trying to meet guys and I was going out, I probably would still be doing it. You know, it's different than like saying you can kill someone by texting while you drive, because texting is something that I absolutely don't have to do. I can pull over. I can stop. I don't have any need to text. But when I'm out and I'm trying to meet somebody and I feel like I need that social crutch of that drink, it's very different.
Right. Gotcha. So much. Thank you so much for that call, Jan. And what do you think about that perspective, Mike? She went through the counseling 30 mm-hmm. years ago. She said right. it was worthless.
I think we most of us live with an illusion of invulnerability. It won't happen to me. So we risk certain behaviors. And then often what she's saying, it won't happen to me again if I persist in the behavior. And that's unfortunate, but it seems to be part of human nature. Maturity is a big part of this. Many of the people, I can also say, I have an OWI when I was 20 in the military. I stopped the behavior probably several years later just because I became more invested in my life and I became more socially responsible and conscious about the effects of my behavior of other people. But, you know, that's a big part of it. You know, one of the things she also mentioned is males are much more risk averse. About 75% of the people who are in this program are males, and many of them are younger males who will take more risk. And that's evidenced by I deal with many more males in the program.
All right. Well, I want to thank Jan for her call. And we're going to move next to Jen in Oak Creek. Hi, Jen.
Hello. I was listening to the program, and one of the things that I've noticed, at least about Milwaukee, is the lack of transportation options. I recall one time in college we were down at Water Street. We called a taxi, waited for 2 hours. Luckily, we were at Marquette, so we just walked home. But, you know, bigger cities have subways, L trains, buses, taxis. So there's so many more options. I feel like sometimes people, you know, who want to drink like Jan, you don't have an option to get home, especially in some of those rural areas.
Right. Thanks a lot, Jen. This is something that's come up before. We've talked about this on the show, lack of public transportation options. And, you know, not just in Milwaukee, in other areas of Wisconsin and in other cities, people say this kind of thing. Is that part of it, Mike?
Yes, it is part of it. You know, people do want to socialize. And how are they going to get to where they're going to socialize? And that is a big part of it. So they'll risk. One of the things is in Oshkosh, we don't have a lot of opportunities for cabs. Either. People will wait 1 to 2 hours. They've been drinking. They might feel, well, I'm not going to wait that long. I want to get home and I want to sleep. And then they might jump in the car and risk. Some of the other problems is the parking policy in some communities where people don't leave their vehicle because it'll get ticketed. I had a friend of mine whose vehicle was towed in the winter, just left it at the bar, but it was towed and it was a $175 fine because they were going to plow. And, you know, so things like that. And you can see where that can influence your thinking, and because you've been drinking, your decision making and willingness to take a risk is enhanced.
All right, let's go to one more quick call here, and we're going to take Kevin in Duluth. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
Well, I obviously do not agree with drinking and driving. Obviously, it's something that I've done many, many times. I'm actually a four-time DUI survivor. And it wasn't until I was married and I had my fourth one in 2000 where the ramifications for that were outrageous, because I'm not a rageous fat, but they needed to be that way. But for me at that time, I was like, oh, my gosh, you've got to be kidding me that I've got to go through all this to get my license back. It's like a year and a half without any even consideration.
Right, when you got kids, that's a big change you're going through there. Kevin had a wake-up call. For him, it was having four kids. And thank you so much for that call, Kevin. Mike, do you think that's something that people need to have, sort of a personal moment of revelation when it comes to their drinking and driving?
I think that can help them, but also somebody that can walk them through it and explain to them, listen, we understand, you know, you did this behavior. We want for you to stop that behavior. And many people, you know, they're willing to risk their freedom, their life, other people's life or freedom to get home. You know, drinking and driving is kind of like an all-in in Texas Hold'em. You're putting it all on the table every time you risk drinking or driving while impaired.
And Mike, in our last moments here, is Stop the Way Forward programs like this community-based solutions?
I think it is, because, you know, we started addressing this issue in 1980 seriously when Candy Leitner began MAD. There have been 2,800 laws passed since 1980, and we're still talking about the issue. And there aren't enough social pressures right now by the citizens to say, let's take care of each other. Yeah, we want to drink, but let's figure out how we can get each other home safely.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Mike Oleg, coordinator of the Safe Streets Treatment Option Program for the Winnebago County Human Services Department. He was with us for the third installment of our series On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, President Obama will lay out his plan for dealing with the militant group ISIS this evening in a speech to the nation. But will Congress play a role in authorizing any use of force? It's our weekly look at Congress.
First, changes could be coming to the way we pay for electricity here in Wisconsin. Three of the state's major utility companies are looking towards raising the fixed charges on consumers' electric bills.
Utility companies say the changes would be modest, consistent with previous action, but energy-conscious consumers are worried that they'd be adversely affected and affect be punished for trying to conserve energy.
The public got to weigh in this morning at a public hearing, and there are more to come, and online comments are welcome as well. Here to talk about what's going on is Steve Keim, chief economist at the Energy Center of Wisconsin. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Steve, you recently spoke to one of our reporters here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and in that interview, you said that this is the biggest issue that you've dealt with in 34 years of working with electricity regulation. How come?
Okay, this is a path toward a completely different way of charging for electricity. The utilities are proposing to take the initial steps. Currently, customers pay a small monthly charge. For example, a residential customer pays a fixed charge of $10 and then about 15 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity. If we run this rate design all the way to its logical conclusion, and the utilities have testified that this is perhaps a step toward this ultimate goal, we will turn that on its head, and the fixed charge would be something like $65 a month, from 10 to 65, and the volumetric charge will go from 15 down to 4. So I characterize this, the existing rate design is like filling your tank with gasoline. Mostly, the more you use, the more you pay. This proposal, if it's gone to its full conclusion, becomes more like, not perfectly like, a cable bill, because the lowest your bill could be under that ultimate design would be $65 a month. So that's basically a topsy-turvy inversion of rate design. And that's why I say it is so fundamentally changing. And then, of course, the price signals that come from that are then dramatically different.
Well, cable companies are not exactly popular these days. Why are utility companies trying to follow suit and pick up a model that looks more like that?
The utilities are trying to reflect their existing cost structures, their historical accounting cost structures, which at any point in time, if we take a snapshot today, if you look at a utility, it's a lot of steel, concrete, wires, poles, offices. If usage goes up and down, those costs don't change. The main thing that changes is the cost of burning fuel to generate electricity. So in a very short time frame, a lot of the costs are fixed, so they're trying to match their design of prices to that historical cost structure. Now, that there's a lot of controversy about whether that's appropriate or not, but that is basically the idea of matching the largely fixed cost nature of their system in their pricing.
I want to get to that controversy in just a moment, but in terms of what that, say, sample $65 that you mentioned pays for, what are the utilities saying that cost is going to go towards?
Well, it will go toward all of their plant and service, so their power plant, transmission lines, distribution lines, substations, their office building, their trucks. And even in the short run, their workforce is largely fixed. It goes toward that lion's share of those costs. So it's in the very short run, those costs are fixed. And so that is a match to those costs.
Okay, and looking at the controversy you mentioned, and some of this, I gather, is from consumers who might be saying, hey, but if I'm using less electricity, I want to pay less for it, and this doesn't reward me for doing so. Is that the crux of it?
Yes, and that starts to introduce what I think is the big complexity. The utilities rate design looks backward at their existing cost structure. But if we look forward, then all costs ultimately become variable, because if we use less power, we not only avoid coal, burning coal or gas, we also avoid some power plants, transmission lines, distributions. All of those things I just told you about, when we look forward, are variable costs. And so people who use energy efficiently and the people who are efficiency advocates generally say that's the way we should be looking. And if you price it that way, then the existing rate structure actually is pretty good in that respect because it looks toward all the costs that can be avoided. And then you get a reward for being efficient because you're helping to avoid not just coal and gas, but the additional facilities. So that's the heart of the debate as to whether we should look backward or look forward.
What is driving this, essentially?
The advent and dramatic decline in the cost of distributed solar, where you can put solar panels on your roof and generate some electricity for yourself, is just starting to tiptoe into Wisconsin. And the problem with that from the utility's perspective is if they recover some a large portion of their fixed costs in the volumetric rate, which they do now, every kilowatt hour that a customer generates on his or her own, they get the 15 cents. Let's go back to that example. They essentially get a credit of 15 cents. The utility only in the short run saves 4 or 5 cents in terms of fuel. So the utility actually loses in the short run, say, 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And so if this threat becomes large, then their fear is those costs, the utilities are entitled to a reasonable opportunity to earn or recover their costs. So those costs then get shifted to other customers. So utilities don't like to think, they don't like to lose money, and they're entitled to their profits under the Constitution. And they also don't like to shift costs to other customers. So it's in anticipation, though, of a threat that's actually not quite here yet, not in any significant way. So it's a preparatory, preemptive, perhaps, stance to try to make sure that they're going to recover their costs no matter what happens in the utility markets. And people have seen this. Some of the advocates say this is just protecting utility interests. It's not at all about anything other than that. They make that claim. That's one of the opponents' charges against this rate design, is it's simply to protect the utility.
So if this is a move designed in anticipation of the rise of solar power in Wisconsin, does it also represent sort of a counter move, you know, against moving toward renewable energy?
Yeah, that's another one of the problems that in this country and in this state, we have public policies that support the use of energy efficiency and renewable energy resources. This rate design, while it does a really good job of recovering the historical cost, has a fairly significant hurdle to overcome in that it actually makes renewable energy and energy efficiency much less attractive and therefore runs straight into a public policy that seems to be headed toward more efficiency, more renewables. That is going to be a major, major issue of contention because we're actually seeming to run counter to public policy in that respect.
Now, people are getting involved, citizens, people who have to use utilities. What are they saying, and how are they hoping to sway the argument?
Well, a lot of the arguments I've actually summarized, and I'll call this the attack the utility as being greedy, which is this is just an investor protection plan. That's one argument that's being made. Another argument being made is that the utility costs really aren't fixed even in the short run, that they depend much more on usage than the utilities suggest. And then the final one is real, and there probably are more. There's so many issues here, I don't know if I'll get them all, but is this energy efficiency, renewable energy perspective. And for example, we have an entity, Johnson Controls, is actually involved in this. That's a big, big player here. It's not just some consumers, not to denigrate the small consumer at all, but when you have an entity like Johnson Controls coming and saying, we don't like this rate design, now we've upped the ante in terms of opposition.
And in terms of the comment period, is it ongoing? If people want to weigh in right now, they're hearing you on the radio, they want to chime in, what do they do?
They can do one of two things. One, they can attend a hearing and be heard in the hearing. They can also file comments on the Wisconsin Public Service Commission's website. I think one of the groups in opposition, Renew, has a website. You might actually be able to understand the PSC's website a little more easily if you go to the Renew site. But if you go to the Wisconsin Commission site, you can also file comments. But there are three separate cases: the Wisconsin Public Service Corporation case, Madison Gas and Electric case, and the We Energies case. So there, you would have to file comments in all three cases in that way, or attend all three hearings. Now, you might just go to the one that affects you, whatever your utility is, but there are forum for, I guess, I don't know what the plural is, to actually be heard.
And Steve, we'll give you the final word here. When is the final decision going to be made?
So the commission will actually, there will be hearings, and they will assemble an evidentiary record. And so all of these comments will go in, and there will be cross-examination of technical witnesses. If a public witness goes, they won't be subject to cross-examination. But the utilities witness experts and the other parties will go after each other, just like in a courtroom, and a record will be built. And then ultimately, probably December, these decisions, the Public Service Commission, the three appointed officials, Chairman Montgomery, Ellen Nowak, and Eric Callisto, will reach a decision. Maybe they will agree. Maybe they will fight. At some point, it'll be 2-1 or 3-0, and then we'll have decisions in each of these cases.
Okay, we'll be watching. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Steve Keim is chief economist at the Energy Center of Wisconsin. We've been talking to him about proposed changes to electricity rates in the state.
It's time for a weekly look at what's happening in Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. The nation's legislature is back in Washington this week after their August recess. It's time to address the militant group ISIS.
The president will lay out his plan to address threats from the group this evening, but what role will Congress play? The president has not committed to asking Congress for permission to strike ISIS in Syria, and with an upcoming election, it's not clear if Congress wants to vote on the issue.
And by the way, tonight, President Obama is speaking at 8, and we'll have that here on Wisconsin Public Radio, so you can check it out. You don't want to wait that long, though, so we'll preview a little bit with Paul Singer now. Paul, good to have you back.
Great to be back on the air with you guys. How are you?
Well, great, great. Good to have you back. So do we know yet what President Obama is likely to say about his plan to target this Islamic State movement?
Not really. We're expecting a briefing, actually, on background from the White House in about an hour that'll give us a little more detail. I think the gist of this is going to be that there are going to be more assistance to the Syrian opposition that has opposed both President Assad there, but could also be some assistance to us in combating ISIS. There will be, obviously, more conversations about bolstering the Iraqi military, and I presume also more conversation about working with the Kurds more closely in arming them, training them, other sorts of things. What I don't think we're going to talk about in any kind of detail is airstrikes across the border in Syria, although that is something that is clearly of great interest and discussion here in Washington. There, a lot of folks think that there's no way you can really combat ISIS without airstrikes in Syria. Hard to figure out how to sort of get at that issue because, of course, now you're starting opening essentially another war front in another country.
Now, is Congress pushing for a vote on the use of force in Syria as a whole, in Iraq, at any point here?
No, Congress is largely hiding under their desks. I think the issue for Congress is basically this. They want to be supportive of an American, a sort of a muscular American response to ISIS, ISIL, ISIS, however you want to call it. But they don't really want to vote on it. They obviously, there are elections going on. People don't want to be responsible for, casting the vote to get America into another war. That did not go so well for candidates in the previous elections. I don't know that, the Obama administration has said very clearly, and the president has said very clearly, that he has the authority he needs, he believes, to conduct this military action against ISIS. Where I think you'll find Congress involved is they will probably be asked by the administration for more money, money specifically to carry out some of this military campaign. My favorite soapbox thing, our military that we spend $500 billion, $600 billion a year funding, that money doesn't pay for wars. Wars cost extra.
Mm-hmm.
So when we start launching missiles and moving troops and stuff like that, it just costs more money. So Obama will probably ask them for some funding for that. There is a funding bill coming up. Your news report just mentioned that short-term funding bill will come up next week. I suspect there will be some opportunity to vote on money for this initiative in there.
Are we seeing any leading voices in Congress saying
no.
Whether you want to vote or not, we should have one?
No.
No.
Not really. Mitch McConnell yesterday said he thought it was important for Congress to have a vote and be supportive. The Senate Republican leader. Nobody else really has. In fact, interestingly enough, there was a Democratic congressman, senator, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking. I think it was Nelson of Florida, who said, "I'm going to offer a bill or resolution to vote on ISIS attacks. But then he said basically, yeah, I'm offering it just because I think we ought to offer it, but I'm not really sure I want to vote on it either. It's a hard thicket for Congress to tiptoe through. They're not sure what their role is. They're not sure what they can do, and of course they don't want to contradict or complicate the military's efforts here to fight these militants in Iraq and Syria.
Well, we'll see if the president calls on anything from Congress tonight. Another note, a militarization issue a little closer to home. A Senate Committee on Homeland Security held a hearing to discuss the militarization of local police. This is in light of the protests in Ferguson and the police response there. A lot of condemnation from some people on both sides on the use of military equipment by local police departments. Is Congress, was this just kind of a thing for show, or is Congress going to seriously review this issue?
My guess is somewhere in between. I mean, I would not be at all surprised. The thing that was interesting about that hearing is that the federal officials who oversee these programs that give military surplus items, essentially, to local police departments, is that they all sort of agreed that they don't really track the stuff. They don't know what happens to it after it leaves and goes to the local police departments. They don't actually really do a needs assessment either. So they're never entirely sure who's using it for what. So I think the Senate's approach was, or the senators at this hearing, they were like, well, I mean, if we're going to be giving away all this equipment, shouldn't we know more about what good it's doing, whether it is useful, how it's being used, who really needs it? I would not be surprised to see them try and establish some additional review of those programs for that purpose. Now, I'll also say that a bunch of the law enforcement community said, you know, this stuff actually is really helpful. And during the Boston Marathon bombing, a lot of the stuff we had done with Homeland Security and with federal funding was helpful to the local police. In Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, we were driving armored vehicles in places where we couldn't drive cars because the bridges were out. So it's not just that people with tanks go to break up protests of unarmed civilians. It really is, they say, helping local communities be safer and be better equipped. It's not just a one-way street that it's you know, throwing all this hardware into the street for no purpose.
So we might see not a ban on military equipment going to police departments,
no,
but some kind of, as you said, needs assessment, oversight,
yeah,
for exactly where it's going.
Yeah, I think it's you're likely to get more oversight, certainly not a ban. I think this program will prove to have sufficient value that they're going to retain them in some way.
Well, turning to election season, we've been following with you, Paul, a lot of the key races for control of the Senate. We had a primary in one of those yesterday in New Hampshire. Former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, right, won his,
yes,
primary, challenging incumbent Democrat Jeanne Shaheen. Jeanne?
Yes.
So what's at stake in this race? Is this really a key?
It's hard to tell at this point, Rob. I mean, we don't know how close this race is going to be. We don't know how serious a challenge Scott Brown poses to Jeanne Shaheen. There have been polls that have shown her up by 10, 12 points. That's fairly significant, but there was one poll that popped up a week or so ago that suggested it was only a couple of points that she was ahead by, and that's more interesting.
Well, Scott Brown's been underestimated before.
Scott Brown's been underestimated before. I mean, I think his problem, of course, is that he hasn't lived in New Hampshire for a long time, so that's an issue. And so he's seen as an outsider, and obviously the Shaheen campaign is going to drumbeat on that topic for a long time. But even if he doesn't win, of course, he requires Democrats to spend a lot of time and energy in New Hampshire defending a seat they were not expecting to have to work hard to defend. To some degree, the fact that you and I are spending time having a conversation about New Hampshire, the Republicans are already in an advantage that they were not expecting to be 6 months ago. So that's good for them. Whether Scott Brown can actually win this seat or not, I honestly don't know. My impression is that Shaheen is fairly popular and will probably come out ahead. But, we still have 8 weeks, and let's see how the campaign goes.
Well, less than 2 months till those elections. What is at the top of Congress's to-do list between now and then?
Well, the first thing they got to do is this spending bill. Nobody wants to shut down the government again on September 30th. So they've got to get a spending bill passed by then. The plan is to do a temporary bill as usual, kick the can down the road until middle December, so that after the elections, the lame duck Congress can come back and come up with a better, more long-term budget plan for the rest of the year. That is the only really must-do thing in the next 2.5 weeks. And in fact, it's possible they're scheduled to be here for 3 weeks. That's 2 weeks of work, 1 week off for Rosh Hashanah, and then 1 week back. It's possible they'll cancel the 1 week back because there's just not enough to do.
All right, Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. You all have a good night.
You too. That's USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. We've been talking about what's going down in Washington as legislators return from their August vacation. He joins us each week at this time to talk Congress.